is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal hayyul qayyum. لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم
the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. The UN chief warns of an economic collapse in Afghanistan, calling on the international community to provide humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. Palestinian groups and factions declare Friday a day of rage to protest against Israel's decision to relocate inmates following a jailbreak this week. And Chinese President Xi Jinping says U.S. policies towards Beijing have caused serious difficulties in the relationship between the two countries. Thank you for joining us. UN has warned of an economic collapse in Afghanistan and called on the international community to maintain a dialogue with the Taliban.
Naturally, the Taliban want to be recognized. They want the sanctions to be lifted. They want financial support, and this gives the international community some leverage. I think that naturally we don't have an internationally recognized government yet, but I also think that we have to avoid an economic collapse situation which could create appalling humanitarian consequences for the Afghan people.
Guterres added millions of Afghans could die if an economic collapse happens in their country. The UN chief urged the international community to provide humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. The state of Afghanistan must be governed in peace and stability, and the rights of all people must be respected. Guterres also said the United Nations wants an inclusive government in that country. On Tuesday, the Taliban announced an interim all-male government. They did so 3 weeks after they seized power in Afghanistan following sweeping territorial gains. Alireza Khomeili is a researcher on Islamic groups and lives in the Afghan capital. Earlier, he joined us from Kabul and explained how things have changed under the Taliban rule.
I'm now in Kabul. I see the situation, economical situation is not good. I don't know is it collapsed or not, but I know that a huge amount of the budgets or income of Afghanistan was from the outside, so the funding of Afghanistan should be continued. The situation in the bazaar is not good. Some of the people are displaced, but I think the situation now is normal because the security is everywhere, and maybe it will be better, but the funds of the foreigners should be continued, because till now the new government couldn't catch the new incomes for Afghanistan, so the previous incomes should be continued for the Afghans.
Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations called for the formation of a truly inclusive government in Afghanistan that has emerged from a free and fair election.
Indeed, the path to a stability, durable peace and sustainable development in Afghanistan passes through intra-Afghan talks with the active and equal participation of the true representatives of all ethnic, linguistic and religious groups aimed at finding a just, peaceful and durable solution to the crisis, achieving national reconciliation and establishing a truly inclusive, broad-based and fully representative government that is emerged from a free and fair elections, including with the full participation of women both as voters and candidates.
Addressing a Security Council meeting, Majid Takht-Ravanchi expressed concerns over the presence of terrorist groups in Afghanistan. He said terrorists like Daesh must not be allowed to operate in the country. The Iranian diplomat also condemned a recent attack by the Taliban on Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley, where there was a resistance against the group. Takht-Ravanchi described the attack as unjustifiable and condemnable. He stressed that Afghanistan's dire situation, where millions need humanitarian assistance to live by, is the direct result of the 20-year U.S. war in the country. He noted that war crimes by foreign forces in Afghanistan must not go unpunished. Political commentator Jason Andruha says Western powers can't punish the Afghan people just because they don't like the Taliban.
You know, just because the Western powers don't actually like the Taliban or the way the Taliban does business or the fact that they lost the war to the Taliban, this is absolutely no reason to punish the people of Afghanistan. In fact, it would be a very heartless measure to simply cut off aid to the poor simply because you don't like who the government is. I mean, this is what we're supposed to believe, that the whole point of going to war in Afghanistan was to, you know, fight terrorism and liberate the Afghani people. Well, there's nothing very liberating about going hungry or not having any medical treatment available for anyone who needs it. In fact, withholding these would definitely show the true intention of the United States, and that it was only intended to control the country, and many of the other Western powers as well, such as the UK. Now, their only real intention was to gain control of the country.
Palestinian groups and factions have declared Friday a day of rage to protest against Israel's decision to relocate inmates following a jailbreak this week. In a statement, the resistance movement Hamas called on the Palestinian people to voice their anger at the Israeli occupation and its aggression against prisoners. In the meantime, a Palestinian Authority official warned that Israel's quote repressive practices could spark a new uprising. On Monday, six Palestinian inmates broke out of a heavily guarded Israeli prison. The regime has launched a manhunt for the inmates. Palestinians have warned Israel of major unrest if any of the six prisoners is killed. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held several rallies to condemn Israel's new violent measures against Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails following the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Gilboa prison. Ruba Shabbat reports from Gaza.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Gilboa prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Gilboa prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Gilboa prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army. Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent, as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabbat, Gaza.
Chinese President Xi Jinping says U.S. policies towards Beijing have caused, quote, serious difficulties in their bilateral ties. Xi made the comment in a phone call with his American counterpart, Joe Biden. The Chinese president called for putting ties back on track. He said that's critical for the future and the destiny of the world. Biden made it clear that Washington welcomes competition, but does not want it to lead to conflict. That's according to a senior official of his administration. The official said the goal of the phone conversation was to set out, quote, guardrails to ensure that relations can be managed responsibly. Ties have secured between China and the U.S. in the past several years over a number of issues, including trade and security. A U.S. media poll says many Americans believe that events after September 11, 2001 had a more negative than a positive impact on the country. According to the survey conducted by Washington Post and ABC News, 46% of the people say the events of 9/11 changed the country for the worse, while 33% believe they changed the country for the better. That represents a large swing from the first anniversary of the attacks in 2002. Back then, 55% said the country had changed for the better. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on 9/11 when hijacked airplanes smashed into the World Trade Center towers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. Political analyst Dion Williams says the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks was disproportionate.
The reaction in Afghanistan was completely disproportionate. The small group of people who conducted these raids were, as you pointed out, more closely related to the Saudis than to the Afghans. And when the army did go in there, into Afghanistan, which allegedly was the cause and the root of the terrorists, They didn't go with huge armies. They used mercenaries. They used warlords. They used people. Well, they were used war criminals, basically. And they were paid for from CIA funds to get rid of the Taliban, while the main military force and money was spent in Iraq, which was completely unrelated. I mean, what could go wrong by hitting the wrong target with the wrong forces while, you know, and ignoring the real target?
The U.S. surveillance of its citizens is a known fact, but what is not known is the extent of the surveillance, which some have called spying. A new poll has found that Americans are not keen on their government spying on them. But the way the U.S. government goes about spying and how it uses its surveillance data against the ones it targets, that is what's controversial.
A recent poll has found that more Americans were against the government's intrusive surveillance programs. The poll was conducted by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research and interviewed over 1,700 American adults in mid-August. According to the poll, 46% of Americans say that they oppose the U.S. government responding to threats against the nation by reading emails sent between people outside of the U.S. without a warrant. That's compared to just 27% who are in favor. In an AP-NORC poll conducted one decade ago, 47% favored the practice, but only 30% of Americans opposed the move. The poll found bipartisan concerns about the scope of surveillance and the expansive intelligence collection tools that U.S. authorities have at their disposal. The poll also says that 44% of Americans are also more likely to oppose government eavesdropping on calls outside of the U.S. without a warrant. Only 28% of Americans favor the practice.
Well, I think the big problem today has been less surveillance and other kinds of censorship of social media. I mean, that's turned out to be much more important, I think. I mean, the government and private agencies, private companies are actively censoring the social media of all sorts and seriously affecting what the information that ordinary Americans are able to access.
Most Americans taking part in the poll, about 6 in 10, said the long U.S. wars fought in Afghanistan and Iraq were not worth fighting. According to the poll, about two-thirds of Americans say that they were extremely or very worried about the threat posed by homegrown extremist groups.
The U.S. spying program increased vastly after the 9/11 attacks, but the scope of this spying was not realized until the revelations of former NSA contractor and whistleblower Edward Snowden. One example, he revealed that 9 internet firms spied on Americans, including Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo. That included emails, search engines, and you name it, the full scope of how the internet was used. Australia's new daily COVID infections have surged past 1,900. That marks the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. New South Wales reported over 1,500 of the new cases. The southeastern state is the epicenter of the current outbreak in Australia. That's the worst outbreak there. It began in mid-July and has been fueled by the highly infectious Delta variant. The rest of the new daily cases were logged in Victoria state. Both Victoria and New South Wales have been under lockdown for weeks now to curb the virus spread. Authorities are now planning to ease some restrictions over the next few weeks as they are getting close to their target of inoculating residents. And that does it for this edition of World News.
IB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones. in the limelight.
Airstrikes conducted by the United States have killed between 22,000 and 48,000 civilians since September 11, 2001, according to a report published recently by AirWars, a military watchdog that monitors and seeks to reduce civilian harm in violent conflict zones. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. airstrikes have killed up to 48,000 civilians since 9/11, analysis says. Stay tuned for more. Airstrikes conducted by the United States have killed between 22,000 and 48,000 civilians since September 11, 2001, according to a report published recently by AirWars, a military watchdog that monitors and seeks to reduce civilian harm in violent conflict zones. The new analysis released ahead of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the retaliatory launch of the so-called War on Terror came just days after a U.S. drone strike killed at least 10 members of a single family in Kabul amid the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. Most media accounts point out that more than 7,000 U.S. service members have died in post-9/11 wars, but only some go on to state the massive civilian death toll, and almost exclusively in generalities, researchers lamented. While Brown University's Cost of War project estimates that over 387,000 civilians have been killed as a result of the so-called War on Terror, AirWars sought to answer a specific question. How many civilians have likely been killed by U.S. airstrikes in the last 20 years? The answer AirWars found is at least 22,679, and potentially as many 48,308 civilians. Acknowledging the imprecision of their estimate, the group noted that the gap between these two figures reflects the many unknowns when it comes to civilian harm in war. Belligerents rarely track the effects of their own actions, and even then do so poorly, researchers wrote. It is left to local communities, civil society, and international agencies to count the cost. The Pentagon has declared a minimum of 91,340 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Seven countries the U.S. military invaded or assaulted with bombs or drones in the past 20 years. Notable peaks occurred during the 2003 invasion of Iraq between 2015 and 2017, the height of the military offensive against ISIS in Iraq, Syria, and Libya. Given the dubious nature of data supplied by the U.S. military, which notoriously undercounts civilian fatalities, AirWars gathered together every reliable assessment of direct civilian harm caused by U.S. actions to construct a data set that includes information from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, Iraq Body Count, The Nation, the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, and their own previous studies. Wherever possible, we sought to measure civilian harm just from U.S. airstrikes, but in some cases, such as the first years of the Iraq invasion, it was impossible to disaggregate airstrikes from artillery fire and other heavy munitions
which were therefore included. Researchers noted, likewise, in some U.S.-led coalitions, it was impossible to determine whether each individual strike was American, though U.S. air power has dominated all such campaigns. Based on its comprehensive review of credible sources, Air Wars identified 2003 as the deadliest year of the so-called War on Terror, when a minimum of 5,529 civilians were reported to have been killed by U.S. actions. The next deadliest year was 2017, when at least 4,931 civilians were likely killed, the vast majority in alleged coalition bombing of Iraq and Syria, researchers wrote. However, if we conclude maximum estimates of civilian harm, then 2017 was in fact the worst year for civilian casualties, with up to 19,623 killed. According to Air Wars, 97% of reported civilian deaths during the so-called War on Terror took place in three countries, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. Joe Dyke, senior investigator at Air Wars, told Middle East Eye that for much of the last 20 years, people living in Washington or New York could have been forgiven for forgetting their country was at war. Whether a drone strike in a Yemeni village or a military base in rural Afghanistan, it often felt far removed, almost another world. But that isn't how it felt for those millions of people living in those conflicts, Dyke added. Meanwhile, in an email responding to Air Wars' request for official military estimates of civilian casualties in post-9/11 U.S. wars, the Pentagon said that the information review request is not immediately on hand in our offices, as it spans between multiple operations campaigns within a span of between 18 and 20 years.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Benefiting from the money power factors that Hezbollah possesses, not only confined to the regional extent of the resistance strength and influence, or to the naval deterrence equation imposed by Iran, it took Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah only one decision, and the vanguard of Iranian fuel ship convoys began reaching the Syrian territorial waters. Washington and its delegates in Lebanon, the last of whom was a delegation of the U.S. Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, know that Hezbollah's decision is a major breach of the U.S. undeclared sanctions against Lebanon and a major break of the embargo imposed on adopting alternatives that strictly fall within the American-approved basket of options. However, the Americans view the situation from another angle and are more attached to their grand project, especially to Lebanon, which is adjacent to occupied Palestine and thus to Israel's higher interests. The Americans see that Sayyid Nasrallah's last decision has moved Hezbollah from a position of steadfastness in the face of U.S. siege policies and pressures to a position of direct confrontation. And in this position, the Americans take into account the resistance's intention and willingness to reach far in this confrontation. Meanwhile, this transition for Washington means that its tools in Lebanon, whether traditional or even civil society institutions that are known as NGOs, are at stake. Neither are they able to confront the resistance in its decision to confront the American blockade, nor are they able to support it, which deepens the predicament they fell into since Sayyid Nasrallah announced in his speech on the 10th of Muharram the launch of the first fuel ships to break the siege of Lebanon. Hezbollah's decision re-emphasized the importance of Syria in relation to Lebanon, as well as to the axis of resistance. This pushed the U.S. administration through its ambassador in Beirut to hastily announce its intention and readiness to lift part of its sanctions and siege on Syria imposed under the Caesars Act to open the way for electricity and gas from Jordan and Egypt to Lebanon through Syrian territories, obliging an American affirmation of Syria's value and position in relation to Lebanon. The choice of the United States to accept competition with Hezbollah instead of confronting it comes at a historic moment for it in light of its ongoing defeat in Afghanistan, while the Naftali Bennett government in occupied Palestine is left with nothing but trouble after the American withdrawal by activating its aggression raids against Syria. This new situation makes it imperative for the Lebanese state to open up to Syria and provides it with the appropriate opportunity to do so. On the Lebanese side, Hezbollah's major decision puts any future government in front of a fait accompli that will not be able to skip. The designated Prime Minister Najib Mikati tried to gain more time to bypass the arrival of fuel ships. However, the fact that the ships arrived in Syria instead of Lebanon can be considered a kind of a settlement that preserves the faces of the Lebanese state and its institutions, as well as the facts created by the decision in terms of prompting the U.S. administration to stand in line to try to solve Lebanon's economic crisis. Hezbollah has always dealt with great caution with the internal situation in order to avoid conflict with its opponents and allies alike. Today, however, Hezbollah stands at the center of a new equation of confrontation with the United States directly. Hezbollah knows that this battle is inseparable from the main battle related to preserving the resistance, its role, legitimacy, and position, even if it differs in form. Today, however, Hezbollah is preparing for the arrival of the first Iranian ship loaded with petroleum products to declare the fifth victory, this time against U.S. hegemony. After the liberation in 2000 and the July 2006 victory against Israel, the Arsal victory against Takfiri terrorists in 2017, and the victory against Western and Wahhabi-funded terrorists inside Syria. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Iranian ship loaded with fuel, which Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announced on the 10th day of Muharram that it set off from Iran and that its final cargo destination will be Lebanon, entered Syrian territorial waters last week. According to the Al-Akhbar Lebanese Daily, the cargo of the ship will be transported by tankers from Syria to Lebanon after unloading it at the Syrian port of Banias. Now, Al-Akhbar newspaper also stated that the part of the ship's cargo will be donated by Hezbollah to government hospitals and care homes. Now, experts believe that this move will actually increase Hezbollah's popularity both inside and outside Lebanon for taking the initiative to save the Lebanese people from hardships while also defending the country's sovereignty and dignity. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut right here is Dr. Tim Anderson, academic, author, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Dr. Tim, thank you for being with us in Beirut. Now, practically, the U.S. does not care about the welfare of the Lebanese people. They only concern about weakening Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance. If stability achieves this kind of weakening, they will go with stability. If actual chaos achieves this, they will go with chaos. They don't care. But now a convoy of Iranian fuel ship has been ordered by Hezbollah to arrive to Lebanon through Syria, which is breaking both internal monopoly and American hegemony and sanctions against both Lebanon and Syria at the same time. How do you think the U.S. will react to this, or actually is reacting right now to this?
Well, thank you. The first reaction is, of course, they've rapidly tried to mobilize some alternative energy streams. Whether that's going to materialize in the near future is not clear, but that was to do with the idea of getting some energy from Jordan and from Egypt going through Syria. So that was the first stage. Apart from that, I think it's very difficult for the US to do things openly. They really want to preserve the image of themselves as a savior of the region, and that's why it's a game of trying to put the blame on the resistance and trying to avoid the blame themselves. So they have to move quite carefully in the current circumstances, because everyone in this country knows the problem with fuel, and everyone is going to welcome any move to break that blockade.
Well, including breaking the U.S. being itself breaking its own law against Syria. How do you think about that?
Well, the U.S. law, which we should not call sanctions, by the way, they're unilateral coercive measures. They're against Lebanon and against Syria and against Iran, but there have always been these type of exceptions where through the grace and favor of the Secretary of the Treasury in the U.S., they can grant exemptions to people, particularly for the third-party sanctions, which are the things that are most operative here there. So the U.S. can manipulate these sorts of rules as it suits, as we know, and really it'll do it to try and maintain its image in the region, which is, of course, suffering greatly for a range of reasons at the moment.
Well, Iran has proved to be a great friend and ally to all countries in the region, but specifically here, Syria and Lebanon, which fall under the banner of the Axis of Resistance in West Asia. But this time, the Iranian move not only positively affected Lebanon, but also it affected Syria, which saw the first visit by an official Lebanese delegation from the government, despite the fact it's in the resigning government here, but still it's the official delegation, after this Iranian ship also was announced. What made the U.S. allow those government officials to finally visit Damascus? And I'm saying allow because one of the ministers actually said that. He said the U.S. allowed us to do this. What made them allow them to do this and break this Caesar's Act against, basically it was against anyone who deals with the Syrian government. And now they are pushing the Lebanese government to go deal with the Syrian government.
Yes, it's a peculiar word which comes up from time to time, allow, isn't it? And it would be very strange in any other country if we spoke of the government getting permission from some government on the other side of the world to do things, to talk to their neighbours in particular. And of course, that's the rub here, that Lebanon has only one land trading border, and that is with Syria. So therefore, the alternative options that were proposed by the US representative here and her masters were that these potential energy sources, if they are to materialise, would have to come in some way through Syria. So therefore, I think that's why the US granted permission to the representatives of the Lebanese government to visit their neighbour.
Yeah, might I remind or maybe give an info to our audience that half, if not more than half, the ministers of this government and potentially the upcoming government as well already have U.S. passports. So by all means, this is a chaotic scene in Lebanon. But all that the Biden administration today wants from Lebanon is to inflict the greatest possible harm against Hezbollah. And I'm not saying this, it's the Biden administration who keeps saying this at every time and every chance they get. And it never asks or cares about the fate or the future of the Lebanese people, even about the fate and the future of its own assets and of the allies in Lebanon, whether it's political parties, associations, NGOs, you name it. However, Hezbollah's move restored a lot of popularity amongst amongst different areas in Lebanon where they are usually considered anti-resistance areas. People started saying, no, we accept what Hezbollah is doing. That broke a lot of the U.S. plans inside of Lebanon. Would that push the U.S. to end Lebanon's security stability, despite the fact that it's not really good right now, the security, but it's still holding it together?
Well, it's already been undermining Lebanon's security for some time. It's not going to be happy with the fact that the solutions to a lot of Lebanon's problems are going to be better relations with their neighbours. This is not rocket science. But unfortunately, it's something that the big powers have done from the beginning, haven't they? They divided the Levant up into different groups. They divided Lebanon into different confessional groups and so on. They created these sorts of systems, and they specialize in dividing people and keeping them fragmented and weak. And of course, the reverse applies, that the solutions for stability and for energy security, amongst other things, have to be greater cooperation, particularly with neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will continue talking about this matter and about the role of the U.S. in stopping a lot of developing plans and a lot of positive plans for Lebanon since actually before the civil war and later on after this break. Please stay tuned. We will continue talking to Dr. Tim Anderson about the matter of the Iranian fuel ships going and on its way to Beirut.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, in a statement before leaving the Lebanese capital, Beirut, the Democratic senator in the U.S. Congress, Richard Blumenthal, considered that Hezbollah is a rampant cancer that must be eradicated only because the resistance decided to ask its allies for help to rid Lebanon from the fuel crisis. Yes, you heard that right. A foreign member of Congress of a country 10,000 kilometers away from my country had the audacity not only to comment on Lebanese internal affairs, but also made sure to attack the largest and most powerful political bloc and resistance faction in the region. In a statement from Beirut International Airport, Blumenthal then stressed that Lebanon should not rely on Iran to solve its crisis, especially via the fuel ship, stressing that the U.S. administration is actively working to solve the fuel crisis. Yeah, sure. Iranian fuel ships bound for Lebanon exposes U.S. role in fuel crisis in this following report.
At every political pit stop in Lebanon, the old problem of securing electricity and energy in the country resurfaces. Several times, this crisis came close to taking the path to a solution before it collided with various obstacles, setting back the clock by years or even decades. This allowed the nurture of a system that constitutes one of the biggest sources of financial waste, whether for the public treasury or for the foreign currency reserves of the Lebanese Central Bank. Years of incompetence and corruption have brought the energy sector to what it is today, and for the most part, it was intended either to secure the sustainability of the profits of owners of the most expensive private generators that illegally filled the hours of power outage of the state-provided electricity, or in order to block the way for people working to solve the problem so that said people do not appear alone as saviors while others were failures. However, little does the world knows about the role of the United States of America in bringing the situation of the electricity sector in Lebanon to its current terrible state. It is, of course, not a conspiracy theory, as many people claim when they hear the smallest word criticizing their favorite empire. The role of the United States in the electricity crisis starts from the top of the pyramid, that is, from the nature of its system as well as the Lebanese economic system, which is a microcosm of its American counterpart, despite the nature of the relationship between both countries, which can be described as commander-slash-subordinate one. The pillars of the capitalist system depend on making profits, regardless of the environmental, social, economic, health, and human costs, as well as on the exploitation of resources, especially those belonging to weak countries, and the exclusion of everything that might affect the interest of large merchants, large companies, financiers, and the deep state in America. This explains the dependence of the greater part of the world to this day on non-renewable energy, such as oil, gas, coal, etc., to provide electricity and bear its high costs on the planet and its inhabitants, whether it is health, financial, environmental, or human, despite the capacity of renewable energy like the sun, wind, and water to provide many times as much energy as the entire world needs. This American control happens through wars. Without imperialism, the American capitalist system will not be upright or by imposing economic systems that suit the interests of the United States and its companies using various means, most notably international organizations such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The United States wages military and economic wars on countries that have a huge stock of resources and countries that have huge global reserves, such as Iraq, Libya, Venezuela, Iran, and Bolivia, who are astonishingly suffering from electricity crisis. Lebanon is one of those countries, in addition to it being one of the countries in the region over which the Zionist entity makes sure to have leverage over, even if by force. Hence why, in its wars against Lebanon, Israel always targeted energy production plants, fuel tanks, and other energy requirements with the support and patronage of the Americans and the complicity of American assets in Lebanon, whose role in the July 2006 aggression was exposed by WikiLeaks.
Now we continue from Beirut with Dr. Tim Anderson, academic, author, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Tim, donor institutions and state institutions or state donors as well, they place conditions on countries that are considered destructive to their economy, which is what happened in Lebanon and caused a deficit in the state budget as well as the Lebanese energy sector. And it is intended to happen again by the U.S. calling for the IMF to interfere in Lebanon. Thus, we're talking about the Lebanese economy that reached a complete collapse, and the production of mainly poor electricity was automatically affected in our country. All this is directly dictated by the United States of America. Would that be enough for Hezbollah to expand its now new project from getting fuel for the Lebanese people to actually completely solving the energy problem in Lebanon with the help of its allies in West Asia?
I think what you've said is going to happen gradually, step by step, and no doubt it's unpalatable to the big power that this means increased cooperation between Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. I don't think it's going to happen all at once. I think there's no need for other possible options in terms of sources of energy to be developed. But as we know, Hezbollah has a very good credit rating with Iran, a very good credit rating, and it's going to be a very competitive source of energy as it develops, as you've said, coming through Banyas and perhaps being refined there and shipped down into Lebanon. So it's an important first step, but let's see what other options are. It's good for Lebanon if there's a number of different options there. It would be a much more difficult thing for energy security if there were dependence on simply one source of energy.
Well, the issue here is, what if Hezbollah decides to go eco-friendly and get something that benefits Lebanon without actually further damaging our environment? With fuel ships, they went crazy. What would they do if we completely get rid of the use of oil or gas for electricity?
Well, if there are viable alternatives, I mean, that remains to be seen. I'm not sure to what extent that's the case now. There's extreme shortages, and in the short term, I think there's going to be take some time to wean people off the addiction of this diesel and benzene.
Well, the most dangerous thing is that some foreign parties will use their companies and they will take advantage of the current situation in Lebanon to market their desire to invest in new power plants, and their goal will only be to ensure that Lebanon depends on them, is always dependent on them, at least in the energy sector, to say the least. Yani. Thus, the United States is benefiting from the electricity crisis in Lebanon, just like in Latin America, for example, where the countries under U.S. sanctions and hegemony, they have great resources. They have a huge amount of resources, yet they are controlled by the U.S. Can a regional West Asian economic and infrastructure alliance be able to confront this form of neocolonialism? And if so, in what ways do you think it is possible? Not only in energy, what else?
Well, on the first part of your question, I think it's natural there's going to be some private initiatives to fill the gap, because there's a terrible need now. The country is very desperate, and there are huge queues all around for fuel. So I think those private initiatives are natural and necessary in some ways. The danger is there's going to be some inefficiency in developing projects which may not proceed. In terms of the second part of your question, I think it's absolutely essential that this neighbourly cooperation, the development of regional cooperation in infrastructure, energy, in commerce, in finance, in a range of things, develops much further. I think it's really the only medium-term to long-term solution for stability in the energy sector and many other sectors.
Well, Timon, it's wars against Lebanon. We have seen throughout history the Israeli entity targeting energy production facilities and fuel tanks and other infrastructure that are very important for any city in the world, with the support and sponsorship, obviously, of the Americans and the complicity of American assets inside of Lebanon, which was revealed by WikiLeaks after 2006. Will Israel truly just stay put, stay silent when all of this is happening? Will they abide by the new deterrence equation which was raised by Hezbollah to protect the Iranian fuel ships bound for Lebanon? Sayyid Nasrallah was very obvious. He said, these ships are now Lebanese land. What do you think?
Well, we have to look at the current anxiety levels of the Israelis. They are very concerned, particularly with the recent collapse of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. I think the collaborators of the U.S., particularly in their destabilization wars and proxy wars around the region, all looked at Kabul airport and feared it was them falling from those planes, basically. There was apparently a wave of emigration from the Kurdish separatists in the north of Syria. They were despairing that what's going to happen when the U.S. pulls out of there. So the Israelis fear that. They're concerned about that, and I think that's why Bennett went recently to Washington to get some sort of assurances. The Israelis are always looking for some sorts of assurances that if something blows up, if Iran decides finally, for example, to respond to one of the many provocations, or if Syria decides to respond to one of the many provocations and attacks that are carried out, they want to be some sort of guarantee that the U.S. is going to back them up.
Well, American and Israeli wars in Lebanon, they completely destroyed the energy sector, but the war on Syria also harmed the Lebanese economy, given that this is the only land border that we have. Because the Zionist occupation, Lebanon has no other outlet except for Syria because of this occupation. Through Syria, we used to export to Iraq and to the other Persian Gulf countries and to Central Asia as well in certain products. But now, we can't even export anything, and we can't even import electricity or fuel from them. The borders were closed to any kind of interaction, and the relationship between the two countries almost became severe until last week, as we said, when the first official Lebanese delegation actually visited Damascus. We are witnessing a lot of change in the empire's behavior in the post-Afghanistan withdrawal era. Are the days of the empire numbered in West Asia, as its enemies would like to say, or is it just too early to be talking in this manner or in this tone?
I think there is a movement in that direction. There has been a discussion in Washington for some years about a strategic withdrawal from the region. You recall when Trump was campaigning 5 years ago, he was talking about withdrawing from Syria and Iraq. He made some moves that was countermanded by other forces in the so-called deep state, same with Afghanistan. Now, for some time, the Saudis have been trying to get some sort of ceasefire in Yemen. So they know that they're losing. They've been losing for some years. And that affects the way they see the whole big picture.
Well, it does affect it, but there's something very important that we need to remind our audiences about: their presence in Iraq and how complicated it is for the Americans to actually withdraw from Iraq the same way they did in Afghanistan. But what would really push them to leave at this moment, and what would be the other option that would push them to stay?
Well, it's been enunciated by one of the officials at the end of the Trump administration, a man called McGregor, who said that he thought they should withdraw from the areas in which they were losing and consolidate in the areas which they considered their key interests, that is to say Israel, Jordan, some of the Gulf monarchies, for example. A strategic partial withdrawal from the region, because even though they can keep fighting a losing war to try and punish the people who have defeated them, there are some limits to that. And they've been losing in Syria for 6 years now, for example. So I think the occupations in Syria and Iraq are likely to collapse together.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they're still paranoid about this. It doesn't mean they are not concerned. They're not going to try and undermine in other ways
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan, but also what's often spoken of as an Iranian land bridge. If you look at intelligence circles in Israel and the US, they talk about an Iranian land bridge as a great fear. That is to say, you have infrastructure networks from Iran across to the Mediterranean, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But that, of course, would be a great thing for the economic development of the region. This region is backward because it's been so divided, because it's been so smashed up. And those sorts of neighborly cooperation projects are the things that are really going to provide a step out of this terrible situation.
Well, it seems that we're going to have a very interesting end of 2021 and a beginning of a new 2022 where the presence of the Americans is very unstable in the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author, academic, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned for more from the Middle East next week.
In the limelight.
As the Delta variant continues to rage in the United States, maxing out many of the nation's intensive care units, Americans face a severe deficit in direct care nurses and caregivers in their hospitals. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. For-Profit Health System is Worsening a Nursing Shortage Amid Delta Surge. Stay tuned for more.